When your strange faces come out of the rain,
emotions. Emotions will begin.
John Malkovich, John, Mr. Malkovich, sir, Mr. Malkovich, I think I can explain.
Yeah, explain.
My name is Craig Schwartz, and we operate a little business here that simulates for our clientele, well, the experience of being you, actually.
Simulate?
Yeah, after a fashion.
What exactly does that mean?
Well, it's hard to describe.
I want to do it, then.
I'm sure that would pale in comparison to the actual experience.
I want to do it!
But right now, Mr. Hiroshi's in the tube, and he's
got
about...
Let him do it, Craig.
Of course. Right this way, Mr. Malkovich. Compliments of the house.
Welcome to the Tuitions Podcast, where myself, Sue Fire, along with my friend and unique colleague Scrumpy, discuss film and other media through a decades-long lens of mass media consumption. In this episode, we'll be starting our look at the obscure and strange, as well as doing our tribute to Roger Corman. This is the Two Oceans Podcast, so fire up your oscillation overthruster, and let's travel to the eighth dimension as we pass into Episode 6, Series 2. So today we're going to talk about the cinema of the strange, those films that stray off the beaten path and push the limits of logic and conventional narrative to the limits to bring a new twist to an existing genre.
Whereas my father called them head movies.
Head movies. Hey, I like that.
That covered a pretty broad swath. That could be a psychological thriller of any kind, but basically anything that was non-standard was a head movie.
Oh. Yeah, it fits.
Right.
I mean, working through the list today, it's huge. There's no way we're going to cover everything in this episode. But some of it's got, I mean, some of the facets that I noticed that are common between quite a few are that they tend to have like avant-garde visuals. They push the limits of visual storytelling. They mix themes. So you might get horror western and this sort of thing, changing narrative structure, taboo subjects, pushing the boundaries of censorship, all that good stuff. Psychedelic, blurring fantasy and reality comes up a lot, psychological themes. And one that's kind of meta is the kind of sense of community among fans of these films. Because a lot of these films would have been forgotten if people didn't kind of rally together and kind of share their experience around them.
Very true.
Yeah. And it's a nice counterbalance to the mainstream cinema and conformity. Right. I mean, just to give a little bit of background to our experience, Nolan, is what were your early introductions to weird cinema? I mean, we were in a ripe time for it.
Right. And for me, the ripe time was because, we had so few channels on TV to watch stuff that a lot of these things, especially like as we'll discuss on the Roger Corman bit, a lot of the stuff became public domain really quickly. It didn't lock in rights. And so places, channels, the few channels there were that were hungry for content showed this kind of stuff all the time. And what we're talking about here are a lot of the B movies, or what's been referred to as psychotronic in a lot of ways, or something. The real exploitational kind of stuff showed up a lot. So when we talked about the Hong Kong episode or the martial arts episode, we talked in reference to that, monster movies and horror movies in reference to that, literal blaxploitation exploitation films in reference to that. Like there was this waiting library of stuff that was intentionally made and put out there for that very reason, right?
And yeah, I mean, I think we were lucky to grow up in a time when we had so little choice, and that there were budget constraints as well.
Yeah, exactly.
So that forced filmmakers to go abstract because they couldn't show the thing, but they needed to kind of convey the stuff. So they ended up doing symbolic stuff, which ended up just being really weird.
Exactly. Yeah. And budgets and time for the filmmaking itself just force them to be like, okay, well, normally we would bother to explain this, but now we're not going to. that kind of thing. And so much of that became, though, that it's kind of like a standard. Like, you see a movie like that, you know, you just got to the point of accepting that. It was part of the willing suspension. Even if it was laughable, you could laugh at it, though, but you still went along with it.
Well, you know, if I was thinking about, I mean, a lot of these freaked me out when I was a small child, you know, the stuff that we were asked. And to this day, I understand my young self being freaked out by these movies, because we had really far out stuff, like, yeah, things like the Andromeda Strain, Phase 4 about the ants taking over, Soylent Green about eating people. And then, you know, we had Star Wars as well. And then they played, you know, George Lucas's THX 1138, which is a really experimental, bizarre film. And, you know, you're kind of going into it going, oh, it's the guy who made Star Wars. And you're completely unprepared for what you're about to see. And then we had like Twilight Zone, Outer Limits on television, weird shows like The Prisoner, or even the kid shows were pretty strange, you know.
Right.
Had things like Sigmund and the Sea Monsters, Land of the
Lost. Sin Marty Croft stuff. Yeah, was all. Yeah. And again, all from that, but all born from that, like in that particular, you know, born from that same necessity of limits of time and budget that they had. Mm-hmm. And so they're just like, all right, we're just going with it. And we're just going to make you believe that this is real, because we have to believe this is real. We can't indulge any other way.
I mean, you add to that, that during that time period, I think a lot of the kind of wives' tales and things, you know, we kind of look down at other countries and go like, oh, you've got all these superstitions and whatnot. But we grew up in a time of superstition where like Bigfoot was real. Like we've not found him yet, but he's real, because there are plenty of documentaries, you know? And then you had, I mean, some of these movies that they do appear in the list. One I remember just terrifying me, and it's Dr. Seuss's The 5,000 Fingers of Dr. T. It's not made for kids.
No. And that sounds like such a horror movie title too.
Which is it totally is. And then, yeah, weird stuff like Santa Claus Conquers the Martians. And who knows how that came about? You know, some costumer was like, well, we've got all this Christmas stuff and we've got some Martian stuff. Oh, I know what we'll do. You know, sort of this forces them to be creative in terms of, you know, what ends up getting made.
Yeah. And then also for me, also early on, the other thing that helped form it, I mean, again, I'd seen a lot of stuff, but not in the way until the Mystery Science Theater. I started seeing that when it first started, and that helped crystallize a lot of it. It was like, okay, we can laugh at the, you know, I mean, it is making fun of it, but it is, you know, kind of lovingly, rightfully so. Yeah. With a complete nod to it being entertainment. Right. And, you know, that just, that helped sort of curate a lot of it. And when you talked about the, you know, the continuance of some of these movies and such too, you know, it's like, oh, you know, some of them I had seen before, but some of it was like the first time I saw, you know, It Conquered the World, the Corman classic with Lee Van Cleef, that was on Mystery Science Theater. You know, it was, watched it on its own since, but that was my introduction, you know?
Yeah. It reminded me of stuff that I'd forgotten, like Food of the Gods or Night of the Lepus. You know, really kind of wacky things. And then, and I mean, because of that, I also kind of see there's quite a few directors that, you know, I pulled together in a list. You got Cronenberg, Lynch, recent people like Yorgos Lanthimos, you got Al Jodorowsky, Leos Carax. I mean, there's just tons. Ken Russell, you know, I could go on and on. But then there are some of these directors that I think to the layman would seem weird. So your Tim Burton's, M. Night Shyamalan, Wes Anderson, that sort of thing. But I think what if you were to read the script, you'd go, that script is a weird movie. But I think the way that they approach it is so standard that I don't quite classify those as weird movies. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
Like they lack that weird atmosphere that you get.
From weird for people who don't know what weird is.
Right, right. Normal people.
Whatever those are.
Well, I mean,
Wouldn't know weird if it bit him in the ass.
I mean, there's some people that think the Truman Show with Forrest Gump is weird, right?
You're right.
They're not weird. I mean, the other thing that we had as well is, you know, especially through the 90s and going into the noughties, we had things like MTV doing experimental, you know, animation and television. We had Rod Serling with The Twilight Zone. You know, Rod Serling definitely had an influence on films because you could see that kind of template from The Twilight Zone being used in movies like Seconds, right? That's totally a full-length feature Twilight Zone episode.
Zone story, yep.
Right.
And same, and I would argue with Jordan Peele's Us. That's full-length Twilight Zone episode, easily.
Oh, totally. Totally. And then more recently, we've had, you know, Adult Swim as well, kind of championing the kind of weird, you know, more on the sort of humorous side, but still there. And then the Mystery Science Theater, which you already mentioned as well. So, you know, it'll never be mainstream because the weirdness kind of shifts. But I think the one thing that I noticed in the list is I think there's weirdness kind of going back that has never been topped, right? You would think that get weirder and weirder, and it doesn't, you know?
Yeah, you think with permissiveness and changes in, you know, elimination of the Hays Code and
sure,
modern techniques and sensibilities, and you know, everything's like, oh, these movies are all to blame. It's like, well, right, no, you can go back and you can go back and trace some stuff to it. Yeah, like you mentioned on your list, Todd Browning. I mean, nothing tops Freaks.
Well, yeah, no, absolutely.
I mean,
absolutely.
That now people, I mean, it makes people uncomfortable. And it's like, mm-hmm, it's like, well, you know, not one of those like, oh, well, it was a thing at the time. No, it wasn't. You know, and I like, you know, with Del Toro's remake of Alley, Nightmare Alley.
Nightmare Alley,
You know, it's another, you know, same sort of thing. He's like very much obviously, you know, had that same influence on him. But, you know, that same thing. It's the same story. Like, it's sure, just, you know, polished up a bit. But it's just as, you know, it's just as, you know, disturbing and weird and doing what it's meant to do as the original was.
I think this kind of gets into something I've talked about a lot in terms of how people watch movies. Like, one, you need to kind of give yourself over to a lot of these movies,
right? Yes,
and just trust absolutely them. Yeah. Needs your concentration there. And then what I'd also say, and this is especially for sort of cinephiles, people who are like really into the movies, they feel like they need to analyze it, right? And especially coming from, you know, our position and doing sort of a podcast, is sometimes I kind of feel like I need, it's a puzzle to be solved, right?
Right.
And it's kind of infuriating when you come out and go like, I don't get it, you know what I mean? And yeah, sometimes the experience is what you're meant to get. It isn't something where you can kind of logically piece things together unless it's a murder mystery, you know? Mm-hmm. So you got to live in the moment. It's forcing you to live in the moment. You've got the movie for, you know, hour and a half, 2 hours. You just got to focus on that screen and just let it carry you and, you know, leave all the thinking and judgment until after the movie, you know? Yeah. But you've already sort of mentioned Corman, who sadly passed away in the last week.
Passed away,
Now, I think a lot of people who aren't movie buffs probably wouldn't have heard of Roger Corman. But yeah, I think maybe if we kind of begin by talking a little bit about his impact, because, I mean, very similar to the Shaw Brothers during our sort of Kung Fu episode, Corman was prolific. But, you know, unlike the Shaw Brothers, he was so diverse in his output, you know, doing westerns and horror, science fiction, counterculture, teen melodrama. And, you know, also his background is that, you know, he had an eye for talent, you know, Francis Ford Coppola, Jonathan Demme, Martin Scorsese, Joe Dante, James Cameron, actors like Jack Nicholson, Peter Fonda, Dennis Hopper, Bruce Dern, Diane Ladd, William Shatner, right? Mm-hmm. You know, they all kind of cut their teeth with Corman. And, you know, all these names to this day are, you know, well known, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, and it was a film school that wasn't theory. It was, you know, applied. It was, he's like, okay, here's $50,000. You've got 3 days.
Right.
If you could do that, you can do anything. Like, you know, it's kind of a, like, you know, that's going to, it's right in the deep end of the pool. And, You're going to have to make creative choices. You're going to understand how it's a collaborative process. You're going to all have to, everyone has to work together and understand the assignment, you know, otherwise it's all going to fail. And you're, and you can't go over budget. There is no more budget. I mean, you can't take more time. There is no more time.
I mean, this is the thing. He's been really open, you know, to his dying breath in supporting sort of new filmmakers as well, kind of pointing out that nowadays, you know, making the films isn't the problem. It's cheaper. You could do it on your phone, you know? It's cheaper than it's ever been. It's the distribution that becomes more difficult, right? Because a lot of the kind of big international markets where you'd make a lot of money, they don't get proper distribution. I mean, I'm even sort of thinking one of the films I wanted to put on the list was Bo is Afraid, right? It had a showing of about a week here in the UK, in my town. I missed it. And it's not being released onto Blu-ray over here. I know it's released in the States until August. So nearly a year after its theatrical release, is it getting, you know, a sort of home video release, which is crazy. And it's not on any of the streaming platforms either.
It's so weird.
But you know, Corman also mentioned in this interview with BFI that, you know, you also have opportunities with things like YouTube and podcasts and all that other sort of good stuff. But yeah, do you have any sort of films you want to highlight from Corman that stand out for you?
Well, you know, a lot of them that, you know, were constants, at least, again, in that same model of being cheap and easy to show because they were also safe to show, were his Edgar Allan Poe adaptations House that he produced in the 50s. And those always showed up like every October. So it was like, almost like annual viewing. But, you know, Fall of the House of Usher, or I think it is called House of Usher, Mask of the Red Death, the original Little Shop of Horrors.
Pit in the Pendulum.
Yeah. All those were like a constant, you know, always there sort of thing. And then
I know they were all created under very low budgets, but Little Shop of Horrors is the one that I know the statistics on, which was it was shot in 2.5 days for $30,000.
Yeah. And it looks like it, but it also has, you don't have time to get into your two head about it. So it becomes almost a sincere approach to it. You know, it's the same sort of thing with, and another filmmaker we have on our list of, is Ed Wood.
Right.
Who, you know, just may, you know, there's a thing that, at least, you know, are they good films? No. But are they good to watch? Yes. Right? That's part of the appeal, right? Is that the fact that they're not overblown, made by committee, overproduced. They're never overproduced.
Exactly. But I think the big thing with their films as well, and especially sort of Ed Wood, is he didn't believe they were bad movies.
No, you know, right.
And there's sincerity to it as well.
Exactly.
In fact, earlier today I watched Glenn or Glenda, which is insane. It's insane that came out in 1953.
Yeah.
He's just he's just basically doing a treatise about, you know, just be open and nice to people. You don't need to, you know, they're not harming you kind of thing. And talking about transvestites in 1953, it is freaking weird that you know, you've got that Bela Lugosi and Stampeding Buffalo and him shouting, pull the strings, which is a great scene in Tim Burton's
Ode to Ed Wood. Yes.
Yeah. And also Corman, speaking of Little Shop of Horrors, did love the musical translation that Frank Oz did. So it's quite a legacy.
Well, and there's always the thing too, that he was, you know, such a supportive force, even by some kind of proxy or something like that, you know, and just going for the best deal and things like that and trying to secure that, you know, that was the most recent, the last interview we did with Joe Bob Briggs last October, when he started the sword and sorcery genre in the 80s or, you know, or late 70s, early 80s, and doing them all in Argentina and basically saving the Argentinian film community as an actual production or actual, you know, entity, simply by just going there because it was cheap and they would give him the control that he wanted.
Sure.
And, you know, kind of just by, you know, he wasn't trying to do it altruistically. It was like, no, it's cheap and they're down on their luck and I'm going to take advantage of that. But we're both going to come out of this winners. You know,
I mean, this is the other thing that kind of would surprise people, because as he did these kind of, you know, the Hammer type horrors in the 60s. And he did a lot of schlock for sure. But, you know, in the early 70s, he was bringing in films from Ingmar Bergman and Francois Truffaut and Peter Weir and Federico Fellini and Akira Kurosawa. He was bringing these films in that, you know, foreign films ended up having a distributor in the States through Corman. And that was a big deal, you know.
And not just in terms of distribution. And at that time, happened to, you know, capitalize in on the this new thing of the home video market.
Sure.
Because I remember, like, you know, a lot of those foreign films you mentioned, a lot of the ones he produced, you could find those at every video store went to. Everybody carried them because it was like, oh, we need foreign stuff here. This will, you know, I guess people like this, you know. Kind of. But, you know, it's like, I remember seeing the, you know, those boxes, the artwork for Amarcord, Tin Drum, Fantastic Planet, Cries and Whispers, alongside, you know, Death Race and Suburbia and Piranha.
It's brilliant.
And, you know, all those. All of those. And those are all him. Like, in some way or another, you have Roger Corman to thank or blame or both for those being available. And again, being able to capitalize on the new technology and him. I mean, straight to video, when that became a thing, you could tell, you could just see his eyes light up. If he didn't come up with that concept, I don't know who did, but it seems so perfectly suited, because then so much now that we, you know, is laughing at, you know, now is, well, we call it, I still call it straight to video, even though anymore it's straight to streaming, straight to, I don't know what you call it, but straight to, you know, with the straight to, like with the whole Sharknado series,
right?
You know, again, who's behind it? Roger Corman. You know, it's like, that sounds like a Corman. Oh, yeah, there he is.
Welcome.
Yeah, you know, kind of thing. He was able to capitalize on that, as, you know, just because, you know, he saw it as a business, right? He understood the business side without sacrificing anything to it being the business, right?
Yeah.
Every artist that worked with him, pretty much, you know, unless they only worked once or got fired on the set, pretty much really enjoyed working with him because of what they learned. You know, was it the best experience? You know, like, well, I don't want to do that again. I'd rather have more money and more time. But the lessons learned and the support they got and the opportunity they were given and everything. So maybe by this one guy who just had a, you know, very singular vision, but a very broad approach.
And I think to a certain degree, Martin Scorsese has carried the mantle in terms of that kind of support, because Scorsese has been so involved in preserving and making available a lot of international films.
Distribution is what I was going to say. Yeah. Preserving and accessibility.
Yeah.
Yeah. Very much so, I think.
And one other person as well is that 1958 Stakeout on Dope Street, I believe, was one of Irvin Kershner's first or early movies, and that was produced by Corman. And Irvin Kershner, of course, directed Empire Strikes Back, which is the best Star Wars, hands down.
Yes, indeed.
It's me otherwise.
And also worth noting, he also, just in fairness to Corman, the Corman name, Julie Corman, his wife, was there for a long time as a producer as well. And, you know, Roger Corman obviously gets the, because he was the face out there, but Julie Corman was no slouch. Came to producing and having that same spirit and keeping that alive. And I imagine she still will, you know, no reason to stop. And they haven't. But, and, you know, he would be the first one to thank her or put her name first in terms of that, you know, notoriety or infamy or famous, you know, infamy, whatever you want to call it, of just how crazy it could be, but how supportive and also, you know, sharing in the vision and just as driven as he was, you know. So it's, I mean, she, I think her name belongs up there just as much as his.
Yeah.
Because she was there for the majority of
from what I can tell,
900 films.
I think she was quite happy to remain more anonymous. But you know, she was active for sure. And, you know, in 2022, he managed to get on the last Sight and Sound survey as well.
Aww.
And his films, his top 10 films were Chinatown, Citizen Kane, Dr. Strangelove, The Godfather, La Dolce Vita, Lawrence of Arabia, Rashomon, The Seventh Seal, The Tin Drum, and War and Peace.
That's a pretty, pretty good list. I mean,
it's a solid list, isn't it?
And, you know, that's the thing, the Corman stuff especially, but it's the weird films as well. You know, Corman's, again, I think responsible for a lot of my love for cinema, because you understand how to marry passion with the business and delivering something and how to get out there and sort of things. It kind of blends everything together nicely, right? But, you know, going through film school and things like that, a lot of people were just so dismissive of him or his movies because, you know, well, we're in film school. It's not art. I'm like, how is that not art? Let me tell you. Let me tell you about what breeds, you know, necessity in breeding this, you know, and what you consider art and how art is made. And you know, so you know, there was a weird thing. Yeah, that weird tension, right? But that list of, you know, his list of top 10 movies, like any arts, you know, any film school student would, you know, be like, absolutely. Like, but there would be no disagreement with that list.
He also would be sniffy, obviously, given kind of the films that you know, he created as well. It kind of goes back to what we were talking about in the introduction for kind of weird movies is expanding your horizons. It's not about sort of narrowing it, which I think a lot of the film scholars or film snobs will tend to do.
Yeah, they get up their own ass and there's not a lot of light in there.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny because on some of the movies I've done a little bit of background and, you know, movies that I like, and I can tell in the reviews that the people who reviewed them didn't get them. Like, they completely missed the mark. And it's amazing to see these scholars completely not getting it, even though it's, you know, clear as the nose in your face. Cool. Well, shall we start cracking into some of the strange movies then?
I suppose that would be fair.
I suppose. I got a clip for us here.
I have no idea where this will lead us, but I have a definite feeling it will be a place both wonderful and strange.
So we're starting with the batshit and humor of the absurd category.
Yay.
Yay. I mean, these categories are pretty arbitrary. So,
yeah, this is our best of kind of throwing things together. Yeah.
And trying to categorize these movies is not easy.
It's not easy, but it's also like, so it's kind of fun. Like, too. It's like,
some
yeah,
kind of fun. Yeah.
Like when you start looking at splitting those hairs, it's like, okay, really, what would this be? Like, where would, you know, you could have something like, you know, in this, you know, just the humor of the absurd, or they're absurdly humorous, I think would be another good way to throw
you could flip that and it would,
because like you
wouldn't take anything away.
Exactly. So, you know, you mentioned like, you know, the Ed Wood stuff would definitely fall into this. The Ray Dennis Steckler stuff of like the incredible mixed up zombies or creatures who stopped living and became mixed up zombies, you know, or a Rat Fink a Boo Boo. Right, think a boo boo because there was a production problem with the printing on the label, and the and got left off and it became a. So it's supposed to be Rat Fink and Boo Boo, but it's now known as Rat Fink a Boo Boo because of a mistake, which just makes me love it even more, right?
Yeah.
You know, but you've got those in with, you know, something as far as like being John Malkovich,
right?
Or they clone Tyrone, or the Love Witch. Or something is, you know, as elegiac as, you know, you put on here, this like Leonora will never die.
Right.
Or, you know, but then, you know, bump that up against Kung Fu Hustle or Houseu.
We can totally tell that they're the kind of breaking the rules here, because as they're not repeating the template again and again,
are at all.
It's all very different. You know,
they're all frighteningly original. Yeah. There's nothing that there are, but without being like completely experimental, right? Like,
right.
There's tenets that are intact that at least you can use to ground you. Like you said, when you're talking about needing to give yourself over to them, you know, one of my favorites for doing that is early Lars von Trier film, Europa. At the beginning, Max von Sydow is the voiceover and he's the hypnotist.
Yeah.
And he starts counting you down and counting you in. That's what he's doing to get you into the movie.
Well,
like if you don't get hypnotized, that movie is going to be pointless to you. There's no point in even watching it.
I mean,
like you've got to allow yourself to enter into that, to be like, okay, yeah, I feel okay. Let's try this. You know?
Yeah, go for it. I'm trusting you.
Exactly.
I mean, that is a great example. I'd also, I mean, in that and the beginning of Jonathan Glazer's Under the Skin, which kind of opens up with this black screen and these sounds. And then eventually you start seeing these abstract images that kind of pull you in. And it's, you know, within about 30 seconds, you're in that movie. Like you're in the movie. If you're paying proper attention, you are.
Exactly. I would say probably the best example of it is the beginning of Blue Velvet. You were just lulled right into this comfort zone and then right to the ant-covered ear.
Yeah.
And, you know, it just like, boom, there's the hook. The ear's the that's door. Laying the hook.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, that's just masterclass. Like, that's how, you know, it's like, that's how, you know, we talk about sticking the landing. There's also opening the door, kicking open the door, right?
That's a good point. Yeah. Actually, you know? It'd be interesting to make a list of some of the best openings like that that
can right
hold you in, you know. Mm-hmm. Right, so first we have in our list, and unsurprisingly it's not the first that we have from Japan, it's Takeshi Miike's the happiness of the
category
2002.
Oh,
I mean, it's part of a like really small group of musical comedy horrors out there. you know.
Well, at the time, you know, I always joked, and like, it's the best Japanese zombie horror musical out there. Just being the joke being it was the only one. Now that's not, you know, it's like there are more. That's or there are more zombie musicals, at least, if not necessarily Japanese, that come from all over the place, right? There's more than one now.
but the thing about the movie, I mean, interestingly, I found out that it's based on another film from 1998 from Korea called The Quiet Family, which I also want to see because it's about a family who own a hunting lodge and their customers just keep dying, you know, like they by accident, right? But but they just can't help it. And Takeshi Miike was inspired by that. But, you know, that wasn't a musical. This is, you know, like Evil Dead meets.
I bet it didn't have claymation in it either.
Well, yeah, and also didn't open with the line "my uvula," you know, after claymation had stolen it. But at the same time, at its very heart, I mean, it's a funny movie, right? I just find it tons of fun, and the family, for all its flaws, I found really kind of likable and relatable. You know, in the middle of all this chaos, the family made sense, you know?
Well, yeah. And that's, you know, it's one of the things, again, and it's also something to come back to for this whole genre, is that there is usually something at the core, something it's like, it comes back, you know, and oddly enough, a lot of Miike's movies come back to family and the friends you make as family and things like that, that being so important and what it can make you do or put you through.
Right.
Another one, you know, companion to that, you know, obviously, because it deals with a family, it'd be Visitor Q. Which happiest categories I could show to anybody. Visitor Q, probably not, you know, on your first. I'm not going to start you off watching Miike movies with that one.
They might remove themselves from any chat groups they share with you.
They might remove themselves from life, you know, just after that one. Because, yeah, but it's the same idea, right? And again, a lot of these movies, I think, regardless of just that particular director, there is some kind of core appeal to that. There's something, again, we talk about that grounding or something, the hints of familiarity, whether that's a narrative or such too. But I think thematically, there's some things, even when they get really out there and seemingly really thought that's, and I think that's what separates the weird from the purely experimental.
I mean, the interesting thing is a lot of these movies were reviewed quite badly on release. Mm-hmm. Like people were not ready for it. And right. That tends to happen. And then steadily over the years, its stock has been going upwards. Next one, we stay in Japan for Hitoshi Matsumoto's Big Man Japan from 2007. It's kind of what, you know, to superheroes, what Flight of the Conchords or Spinal Tap is to music. You know, all these questions that you might have about, you know, when the Hulk gets big, how does clothes like expand with it? And, you know, this movie actually has an answer. It's kind of ridiculous, but it has an answer. But again, like the previous movie, as crazy as that is, our protagonist has relatable family issues going on. You know, he's not paid enough. He's got a hard time living up to his family's reputation. He's got very sort of human issues. It's not, you know, some kind of weird sort of made up problem. He's got problems that, you know, people can relate to. And the movie as a whole, aside from the fight scenes, which are obviously kind of kaiju monster fights, the rest is actually pretty grounded. Yeah. Considering.
Surprisingly so, yeah.
Right. Agreed. And I'm going to try to keep things in a nice clip here. Mm-hmm. Because I think some of these movies are going to have a bigger conversation than others. But next we've got first to Spike Jonze's, Charlie Kaufman's contributions to this list, being John Malkovich mm-hmm. from 1999.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And again, yeah. It's another one that's just consistently funny, but nails that grounded, almost downbeat tone through the movie.
Well, there's the hint of the tragic that yeah. falls that a lot of these fall into as well, where something is broken and they're trying to fix it and they may or may not succeed. Yeah. And that's the beauty of a lot of these, or at least the appeal, what I call the beauty, the appeal for me, a lot of them is that, you know, maybe they don't,
it doesn't have to, the movie gets out.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly. And some of them shouldn't.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
You know, there's that negotiation that goes on in the narrative. And again, that's not just, it's like, oh, it's just weird. It's like, well, no, and like, oh, isn't that a funny premise? It's like, but they get past that, you know, like yeah. that's where you start. And then it keeps going to something else. It's not, you can't summarize by saying, you know, this movie is about X, that kind of thing. And this, and yeah, being John Malkovich definitely does so, which I guess originally it was supposed to be Steve Buscemi, but he couldn't work it out.
Oh, right.
It was a story I read once. So it became John Malkovich, which I don't know, somehow works even better.
Well, initially the script was just being rejected. Kaufman just couldn't get anyone to pick it up, but everyone was reading it.
Sure.
Apparently it was really popular and is getting passed around. And eventually it got sent to Francis Ford Coppola, who then passed it on to his daughter's then boyfriend, Spike Jonze. Mm-hmm. So it was just through this kind of networking, but no studio wanted it, but everybody wanted to read it.
Right.
And they also didn't have sign off from John Malkovich beforehand. They were kind of banking on that one, which is pretty awesome. I'd also say that some of the weirdness is done so well and so matter of fact in the movie, like the weird office at Lester Corps on the 7.5 floor. Mm-hmm. It's weirdly familiar, you know, from the ridiculous onboarding video to the incompetent management. You know, the fact that you have to stoop in the office is a nice sort of metaphor for having to go to work. It's also great.
Yeah, a lot of that's very similar to like Lanthimos, like in The Lobster.
Oh, totally. Totally.
Something like that, the way the premise operates, it and so matter of factly.
Yeah.
Has that same sort of, again, yeah, humor of the absurd. You're right. Yeah.
And I mean, and the other thing is at the time, it was pretty wild to see Cameron Diaz playing a dowdy character.
Right.
I mean, in everything kind of took you off balance when this was first released. And interestingly, Jonathan Romney at Sight and Sound described it as at once a data screwball comedy, an inquiry into the nature of personality, a metaphysical conspiracy story, and a comment on the way that we invest our own desires into public figures, hollowing them out into blank receptacles. I thought, wow. Okay. Wow.
Yeah.
I mean, that doesn't sound like a movie you'd want to watch, but
right. It is
such a watchable movie.
Indeed.
I mean, basically, Kaufman said that the story originated from, he just had this idea that he wanted to make a story about a man who falls in love with someone who's not his wife. And then all this other stuff just came up around it.
Sure.
Which is wild. And John Malkovich is so good in it. And there's so many good quotes in it. I mean, everything about that movie, especially the first half of the movie, is just laugh out loud funny from the secretary who couldn't understand what he was saying at any point. And the boss who thinks he's got a speech impediment because the secretary doesn't understand anything. It's fantastic. Yeah. Now, in counterbalance to this one, the next on the list is Dream Scenario, which is just come out in 2023 from Christopher Borgli, I believe, with Nicolas Cage and Julianne Nicholson. And there's a reason I put this after being John Malkovich, because it has a lot of the John Malkovich vibes to it, and there are great performances, and the tone is good, but I couldn't help but think of being John Malkovich and what a director like Spike Jonze or Michel Gondry or Jean-Pierre Jeunet might have done with this. Mm-hmm. It's this guy's first movie, by the way. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, he did a good job considering that this is his first feature. And again, it deals with the same idea of the experience of fame or unexpected fame. But another movie that I'd watched in this last week was Buñuel's The Discreet Charm of the Bourgeoisie.
The Bourgeoisie, yes.
And that went so balls to the wall in 1972 in terms of messing with, is this a dream? Is this not a dream? Are we within a dream? That this movie felt almost quaint, you know?
That's right.
Dream scenario. Even the way that he sort of envisioned the dreams is like someone's having a dream about forest and they're these wacky looking mushrooms on the trees. It just felt very uninspired, you know, but
flat.
Yeah. I mean, it's not a bad movie by any means, but it's not the classic that I was hoping for. You know, I had high hopes for it.
And that Buñuel, we showed that in film history class in one of the terms of that later stuff. And nothing threw off the normies more than that with the change in the actresses.
Right.
The actress swap that they don't call out. It's just like, now it's this actress. You know, we change this.
Yeah.
And, the people were losing their fucking minds. It was great. But you can't do that. Why not? It's like, you know, it's just a lot of the, that's the beauty of this whole, you know, tie. A lot of this is just, is really a binary switch in there. You either accept that anything is possible, or then you accept that nothing is possible and it all has to be like crap, like Gladiator or something like that. I don't know.
I mean, it out inceptions Inception. Do you know what I mean? You think about
it. It is the Inception, right?
It is the Inception.
Yeah. Inception, the movie would be a pamphlet to be like, okay, here, come this way.
Right. You know? Anyhow, dream scenario, one of the recent ones now in home release. It's okay. It's okay.
Operators are standing by.
and we're going back to the 80s now, 1984, specifically with W.D. Richter's Adventures of Buckaroo Banzai Across the Eighth Dimension.
Yep. Oh, yes. Back to teenagers, fun time was like, whoa, it's got Peter Weller in it. Awesome. What the hell is this? This is great, but what? Huh? What did I just watch? I don't know, but I had a good time. You know, that's kind of the whole point.
There you are.
Yeah. Exactly.
I mean, it's a funny one because I realized while I was thinking about this movie today, because I still don't know what to write about this movie. The ending is very much like the ending to The Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou. Mm. And both films feature Jeff Goldblum as well.
Yeah, true. Also, yeah.
So I've been meaning to rewatch The Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou, which I love that movie. It's one of the Wes Anderson ones that stand out for me, to see if there's anything else that harkens back to Buckaroo Banzai.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm,
go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, this is one of the movies that went through production hell, mm-hmm. because the producers wanted something like Indiana Jones.
Jones, yeah.
And they weren't going to get it.
Yeah.
So it did not have a pleasant creation. And, you know, I think the producers were just kind of hoping that the writer and director would eventually give up on some of the weirdness, but, you know.
And so doubling down on it.
Yeah. I think they probably doubled down on it. Yeah.
Yeah. And my only complaint with it is that we were promised a sequel at the end of the credits, Buckaroo Banzai versus the World Crime League. And we are still waiting 40 years later. We're still waiting for that sequel. It could still happen.
I mean, the title's amazing, isn't it?
Right. It's like, it said Buckaroo Banzai will return, and Buckaroo Banzai against the World Crime League versus the World Crime League. So I'm just putting that call back out there. Some of us have not forgotten. The North remembers. We have not forgotten, and we are owed this. And if you did something like, I mean, think it's what you could do with this now.
I mean, most of them
do it on, you know, something Netflix, Amazon. I don't know. One of you guys, they have too much money, more money than brains. Just give somebody the idea. I mean, you're not going to make a bad version of it, because you can make something that, you know, nobody knows what's going on, and just be like, oh, well, at least it's true to the, you know, true to the spirit of the original. You know, the possibilities are endless. And the time is ripe.
I mean, this is the thing. So Peter Weller was recently in Guillermo del Toro's Cabinet of Horrors in one of the episodes. Mm-hmm. Jeff Goldblum's still working. Clancy Brown's still around. Mm-hmm. So, you know.
John Lithgow's still around.
Is he?
Isn't he?
I don't think he is.
Lithgow? Lithgow's not dead. Lithgow lives. Even Ellen Barkin's still around,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah, Ellen Barkin's around as well. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you could get pretty much involved, I think. And
I mean, it ain't really, you got enough there, I think.
Yep. Yeah, you have. Yeah. Right.
Okay, we're going back to Japan now. We're going to go real weird again, which is Funky Forest, The First Contact.
Yeah, I had not heard of this one.
Okay, this is from a director called Shunichiro Miki. And this is the one that I was referencing earlier where reviewers just didn't seem to get it. So, and there are a lot of reviews on Rotten Tomatoes. And I looked specifically at the, you know, the starred reviewers, you know, the professional reviewers. And there were a lot on there that thought, because it's a series of sketches, right?
Oh, okay.
But they thought they were meant to be traditional comedy sketches because they were talking about Saturday Night Live and stuff and all of this. And that's not what it is. It is not Saturday Night Live. Each sketch has its own tone, its texture, and most have something off the charts strange in it. I mean, it is an experience, right? If you watch the trailer for it, don't worry. It's not going to spoil anything. There's not too much to spoil. I mean, Charles Mudede, who's a reviewer at The Stranger, the Pacific Northwest, he got it. He understood it. But you have different episodes with titles like The Unpopular with Women Brothers. And two of them are Japanese and one's this like little white kid. It's just not explained. He just, yeah, he's speaking fluent Japanese, but they're all meant to be brothers and they all look entirely different. And you've got the Babbling Hot Spring Vixens is one of the, and it keeps, you know, these clips keep coming back. So you get a part and then it'll go to another clip and then that part will continue later on in the movie. But I don't think they're meant to be like punchlines. I think in like there's a comedy sketch at the beginning, but I think it's kind of satirizing the comedy on Japanese television, right? And that's not meant to be the joke. It's more meta right. than that, but it just felt like a lot of people didn't quite get it.
Stopped right there. Yeah. Didn't
go through. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then some of the clips will just suddenly end and you'll be like, what? Why did it end there? What is going on? Like everything about this movie wrong foots you, but it's a fun experience. And it's very similar in terms of that experience to the next one on our list, which is Nobuhiko Obayashi's House or Houseu from 1977.
Oh yes. Yeah. Not House with the greatest American hero.
Yeah.
Good, but for different reasons. No, this is much different.
This is another Japanese fever dream. Yeah.
Oh, man. And is it? It's just...
But it wastes no time, this movie. Like, it feels like a half hour to me whenever I've watched it, and I've seen it more than once.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it does. And yeah, it's just so all over the place, but not, you know,
it's like Gonzo horror.
Yeah, right. I mean, it is, you know, a haunted house movie at its core.
Yeah.
And some of the techniques and things like that are straight out of something you would see from a William Castle production or something, you know, The Tingler or House of Wax or something like that. You know, it very much has that nod, I think, to those films, but also treading its own road. Let's put it that way. Well,
Obayashi. So, first of all, Toho wanted a film in response to Jaws, the success of Jaws. They wanted their own version of Jaws. This was it. Nobody wanted to take it. Obayashi worked with his preteen daughter, Chigumi, to write the script for this. And you could tell. It's like, definitely, you know, she was a big part in writing this. Mm. But then Toho gave the green light. No one wanted to direct it, so he directed it himself because he wasn't really kind of a director, really. But yeah, this is Japan's response to Jaws, and that takes it to a whole other level. Yeah. You know? I mean, the only thing that I can think of that is related to Jaws in this movie is the piano.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, that's a leap, you know?
Yeah. So, yeah, give me a second. Yeah, okay.
Let me just calibrate again.
Exactly. Constantly. Well, that's the beauty of it. That and like a good, you know, horror movie, much less, you know, anything else, it keeps you on your toes. You don't get to settle in.
Sure. Yeah.
Basically everything's up for grabs. You know, as you see each person go off. Oh yeah, totally. And it's each person goes down their own thing. You know, like, okay, what's awaiting this person? You know, again, that's very standard, right? But how that's going to play out and what it's going to be by the end is going to be something very, very different. I mean, don't expect a traditional anything, but you're not lost.
I mean, the fact that it hangs together is something.
Right.
I know exactly. About this with tone going badly wrong. So this week I watched the film from Alexander Aya, Horns, with Daniel Radcliffe. It's full of good ideas, but it doesn't know if it wants to be a comedy, if it doesn't want to be serious. It doesn't know that the tone was all over. I mean, in Daniel Radcliffe's performance is great in that movie.
Sure.
And yeah. It is okay. But
yeah,
it had all the makings of something much, much better in probably more capable hands. Because the tone was just, you know, and I've got so much respect for people, directors who are managed to keep it together, like being John Malkovich, you know, having that comedy not going too far while still having some sort of menace, and or Brazil, you know, that's able to mix all those things. But yeah, this felt, have you seen it? Have you seen Fit Horns?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I was pretty underwhelmed.
Yeah. Yeah. And I thought it was promising the first, you know, half hour, but then, you know, suddenly you had something that was obviously meant to be a joke, and you're like going, why are you doing this? What? And then it would get deathly, darkly serious with someone giving a very heavy monologue right next to, yeah, just very weird. Right. Speaking of weird, 1974's John Waters, and it could be any John Waters movie, really.
Yeah.
We got Female Trouble on here with Divine and Meek Stole and all the rest.
Indeed. And yeah, what?
This was on a Christmas list, actually. It opens with Divine, Dawn Davenport, kicking off after not getting her cha-cha heels for Christmas. That's how the cha-cha starts. Heels,
exactly.
And it's another one that's about fame, funny enough. So that comes up quite a bit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, oddly enough. And I thought it was, that one's just so... That's the one you'd always kind of, that was like a comfort movie. It's like, oh, let's go back and watch, you know, Female Trouble. So it's like something always, you know, people are going to have a copy of the right people are going to have a copy of that, and Suburbia and Evil Dead 2. You know, well,
that was another one that was a, you know, staple in the video shops when you go there, that they'd have all the John Waters movies, you know, or they'd have a section for midnight movies and they'd be in there.
Yeah, exactly. And and for good reason.
Right. And next on the list, I'm not going to go over this too much because we talked about it earlier, is They Clone Tyrone 2023 from Jewel Taylor. It's another one. It's not overly strange, but strange nonetheless. It's one of those rare black science fiction movies. You know, you don't get a great deal.
It's a unicorn.
Deal to those. Yeah. Yeah. And after that, we go to France for 2009, Stéphane Aubier's A Town Called Panic, or Panique au Voyage, which is animated. Have you seen it?
Not for a long time, but I have seen it.
Yeah. I mean, it's so, so entertaining. And I recommend watching it in the original French with subtitles, because it just adds a whole other level of, I don't know, just hearing the hee-haw, hee-haw, it just makes it that much more funnier to me. I've seen it a few times, and it works with kids as well, but you know, you appreciate it as an adult. I mean, it's reminiscent of like old school slapstick without any malice, right? Its world is just like inventive and refreshing, kind of like Aardman, but maybe a little bit more adult than Aardman. But like it doesn't have any sort of malice in it, you know?
Right.
And next up, we go to Hong Kong for Stephen Chow's 2004 Kung Fu Hustle.
And again, you could also pick most any Stephen Chow.
Oh, totally.
With his, you know, the comedy of the absurd, right?
Shaolin Soccer.
Because, yeah, just to mix in, and it's like, okay, now we're going to have dance number, and now we're going to have this, and
Or you have Looney Tunes physics mixed with Yakuza doing dance routines.
It's
amazing.
Yeah. Plus the folks he got to be in that movie. The titans of the martial arts.
His
hero. The Shaw brothers. Yeah, all his heroes are crammed in that movie. You know, westernized. It's like, who? Then you start looking it up. You're like, holy cow!
Like, right. You know, I mean, it's hard to recognize them, but yeah, you recognize their names.
Mm-hmm.
And the soundtrack from Raymond Wong is amazing. It's really good.
That movie just clicks on so many levels. I just watched it again recently, just for the hell of it, because it's like, you know, because it's one of those things. It's like, and a lot of these movies are like that to me. They're kind of comfort food. Like, it's been too long since I've watched the X, you know, fill in the blank, and it's like, oh yeah, that's the stuff. You know, after so many big budget things and or serious things or whatever, you know, it's nice just to have something to rely on. You know, what these films provide is just a nice break mentally and otherwise, you know, good to replenish the soul.
Yeah. And it's full of references as well. Like, you know, when the harpists attack and they're like, you know, why are you trying to do this assassination kind of thing? And the line that they speak, and by the way, they're both kind of dressed like the Blues Brothers. So there's two of them. Mm-hmm. They're playing the harps. Mm-hmm. And their reply is that they're strictly speaking, we're just musicians, which is Elwood's thing, isn't it? Mm-hmm. And then there's references to Godfather and a few other films in there and some of the Shaw Brothers movies as well. But yeah, terrific movie that. I've been waiting for Stephen Chow to do something else like that.
Right, exactly.
Next on the list is 2016's The Love Witch from Anna Biller. It's strange and it isn't. I mean, it does mm-hmm. what it does very well. I'll give it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I think
that's the best way to put it, I think, because it's, and again, that's also a thing, you know, there's a sincerity here, and then there's a sincerity to kind of a subgenre that almost doesn't exist, but there's some, you know, precedents for other similar horror kind of movies about the siren, more or less, the love witch idea, the way they play it out, you know, being very intentionally calling it out. I think it fits on this list really well. Does it, you know, does its reach exceed its grasp? Probably. Yeah. But the fact that they try.
Yeah.
And they get
love.
A good way there. Exactly.
They definitely know the genre. So.
Yeah. It's not like they're trying to make a quick buck here or anything like that. There's more of a love letter and attempt. It gives it a sincerity of effort that's, you know, makes it worth watching, makes it commendable just for that alone. Right.
Well, we're just coming up to the top of the hour now. And
wow.
We have barely.
So many to go.
So many to go.
So much weird.
We're going to have to continue with the next episode. So
what will come next?
I don't know.
Anything's possible, or nothing is possible. It's all weird, man.
Oceans.